On today's podcast, I'm going to be answering questions. These are all questions that you've asked me on either TikTok or Instagram. So if you've submitted a question recently, keep listening to hear if it's answered.
Hey friends, my name is Emily, and I'm your birth advocate. I'm a labor and delivery nurse that has a passion for helping birthers advocate for themselves against the toxic cultures of labor. I teach you the most up-to-date research surrounding pregnancy and birth, give you tips and tricks I have learned in my profession, and empower you to take back your rights as a birther. So welcome. Keep listening for authentic tips and evidence-based information you can count on. This is your Birth Advocate, the podcast.
Hey guys, welcome to the podcast. This week, your Birth Advocate. I'm so excited to have you here again for another week of great podcasting. I just want to share that it means so much to me when you guys give me feedback on the podcast, how it's helped you, things you want to see, what I did wrong. I love when you give me feedback. Please don't be shy on the feedback. I'm going to share something that someone said just last night to me, and honestly, it made me cry. So this is just to show you how much it means to me when you give me feedback. Someone commented on a recent reel and said, "I listened to all 5 podcasts on my 4-hour drive today, and I feel so informed and confident in standing up for myself if I met with any pushback from nurses or doctors." And that is exactly why I do this podcast, and that's why hearing those things just gives me the encouragement and the motivation to keep going and keep educating everyone on their rights. So thank you to everyone who tells me how I've impacted you. It means a lot. So last week, I did a Instagram story Q&A, and it was asking you to tell me things you've heard about labor and delivery, but you're not sure is true. So the prompt was, is it true that ... and you were to fill in the blank. I had so many questions, and unfortunately, I was really busy and I could not get to all of them. I decided to leave them for this podcast so that I could answer them and honestly answer them much more thoroughly than I would have been able to on Instagram stories. So that is where I'm getting all of these questions for. Plus, I just posted a TikTok for Q&A, so we'll see if anybody comments on that. So one of the first questions is it true that an epidural doesn't work immediately? That's a great question. I always tell my patients when they're getting an epidural that an epidural works like a sunset, not a light switch. So as soon as they place the epidural, it's not going to be a light switch and boom, the lights are off, your pain is gone. It's going to be like a sunset. Gradually, the sun goes down and it gets darker. Gradually, your pain starts to go away. Typically, once you lay back from an epidural, every contraction will start to feel a little bit better and a little bit shorter until you don't realize that you're having them. So it's not like it takes 20 minutes for it to work at all. It just typically takes about 20 minutes for it to work to its full effectiveness. Now, this is also widely dependent on what medications the CRNA uses, and there's several of them and kind of their technique. But in general terms, you can expect about 20 minutes till everything goes away. Here is another great epidural question. Is it true I have to labor on my back if I accept epidural /IV pain management? And no, that is definitely not true. And if you've been following me for a while, you know this is a hill that I will die on. Movement is key to labor. And it doesn't matter what kind of pain medication you get, you can always be moved. You should never be left in one position for more than an hour unless there's something else going on. For example, if they found that every time they move you on your right side, the baby starts having distress. So they may try to avoid that side, but there are also other positions that they can do to keep you moving. It is so important. And if your nurse is not moving you at least every hour, I want you to push the call bell light every hour or have your support person push the call bell light every hour and ask them to move you. Because honestly, this is, in my opinion, the number one thing that slows down labor after an epidural. When is it safe to start inducing labor naturally? Currently 37 weeks. This is also a really good question, and I'll probably say that about all of them because you guys just have good questions. 37 weeks is term, so technically, yes, it would be safe to start inducing labor naturally, but I will tell you, in my experience, when babies are closer to 37 weeks, they can kind of act like a preterm sometimes, and so you might want to wait till at least 38 weeks, but technically, it is term, and it is safe to induce labor at 37 weeks, but There's a reason why they won't do elective inductions until 39 weeks. So babies are kind of unpredictable at the 37-week mark. I think that inducing labor naturally also, and this is kind of a side thing, doesn't really have to do with what she asked, but nothing is going to put you into labor. No natural things are going to put you into labor if your body's not ready to be in labor. So a lot of people will tell you to have intercourse, they'll tell you to eat pineapple, they'll tell you to walk a ton, they'll tell you to, I mean, just all of these things. And none of that is going to work unless your body's ready. There are some things that scientifically help your cervix get ready for labor. So usually, typically, these things have prostaglandins in them or create prostaglandins, and that will help you to soften your cervix, to thin it out, so that when labor does happen, your cervix is more ready for it. That's what I recommend. And I just want everyone to know that nothing that you do at home is going to start active labor unless your body is ready. So some things that you can do that have been shown to help your cervix get ready for labor are evening primrose oil, sex, orgasms, stripping the membranes. That's something that your doctor has to do. All of these things help your cervix soften and get you ready for labor, but none of them will create active labor typically. Is it true that people with a heart-shaped uterus can have a vaginal delivery? I have not found that to be true. I have had a patient deliver vaginally after a C-section with an entire septum down her uterus, cervix, and vagina. So I don't think that it's impossible. Sometimes they say that you'll have a harder time contracting. There are also some other things that you're at higher risk for, like location of the placenta and things like that when you have a heart-shaped uterus. But it's not impossible. Just having that shaped uterus is not an indication for a C-section. If you've attempted epidural twice that didn't work and have spinal problems, is it even possible to try? Yes. Every CRNA has a different skill set. Every time you're pregnant, it affects your spine different ways. And I'll just give you a personal story. With my first pregnancy, it took them over an hour to get my epidural. It was kind of miserable. When they finally did get it, it was the last time that they were going to try. And if they didn't get it that time, then they said that they weren't going to try again. And the CRNA attributed it to scoliosis. And I never heard that I had scoliosis before, although it's not uncommon for scoliosis to get worse, like in your pregnancy. So I was like, dang, I don't even know if I'm going to be able to get an epidural with my second one. So my second baby comes around. It takes them 3 tries to get it. And then it's in my vein instead of in my epidural space, which is very dangerous. So they had to take it out. And then they got it the 4th time in the right spot. So my third baby, I was like really worried about this by this time. I was like, oh my gosh, I do not know if this is going to work. I've had terrible experiences. Now, all of my epidurals worked once they got them, but the putting in process was miserable. This CRNA literally got it in 5 minutes. No problem, smooth like butter, worked great. So that's just to say that everybody has a different skill set. Your body changes differently with each pregnancy. So I think that if you want an epidural, that it's not a bad thing to try. All you can do is try. You could also, when you get to the hospital or even talk to your providers about this beforehand, getting a consult from the CRNA and they will look at your back and give you better advice. Is it true that you must have a C-section if you have placenta previa? Yes. There's just no way around it. So a complete placenta previa is when the placenta is blocking the cervix. So the placenta is in front of the exit. As your cervix dilates and as your baby comes through, there's no way for that to happen without the placenta breaking. The placenta is the lifeline of your baby. It also is connected to very big blood vessels in your uterus, and if that breaks, not only can it be fatal to the baby, it also can be fatal to you. Now, if it breaks, let's just say in pregnancy, and you come to the hospital and they get you back to the OR, everything can be fine if it's acted on quickly. But you cannot deliver out of that with your baby being able to have blood supply continually and you not being affected. I hope that makes sense. They also have it where it's not all the way covering your cervix. Honestly, any placenta previa can move and it doesn't have to be completely covering your cervix. So if you're earlier on in your pregnancy and you've heard this, don't be scared yet. listen to the doctor's instructions, but it can move. But if it doesn't move, yes, it's an indication for a C-section. Is it true that Pitocin is overused? Oh man, this is a hill I will die on. Again, another hill I'll die on. Yes, in my experience, Pitocin is way overused. And let me give you an example, a couple examples. Top three ways I see it being overused is one, patients come in and their cervix is not favorable, which means that it's probably closed, it's really thick, it's not soft. There's a scoring system that we use, but it's not favorable, and their induction is started with Pitocin. That is not appropriate unless there's a contraindication to the other medications we can give you. That's not appropriate. Your cervix is not ready for Pitocin. Pitocin is like active labor. It gives your body active labor contractions. And if your cervix has not done any early labor and we try to just throw active labor on it, it's going to be a longer process. Not saying it's not going to work, but it is, in my experience, higher chances of it not being effective. But the big risk with Pitocin is that the longer you're on it and the higher rate that you're on it, more risk that you are to hemorrhage. So why would we give you that when it's too early? It's not going to do much for you. If your cervix is not dilated a lot, you need some sort of cervical ripening agent, Cytotec, Cervidil, prostaglandin gel, something like that to help soften it, open it up a little bit, thin it out, and get it ready for those active labor contractions. So that's the first way. The second way that I see it's overused, someone comes in and there's water, it's broken with no contractions, not really a ton of cervical change, like they're not in labor, their water just broke. This happens sometimes, it's called premature rupture of membranes. And new research is going out that you can wait, I mean, some say 6 to 12 hours, some say 12 to 24 hours before inducing, as long as everything is good with baby and there's no risk factors. And instead, people are coming to the hospital and just getting Pitocin right away, not giving your body a chance to start labor. Again, that means that you're going to be on Pitocin for longer, your risk of hemorrhage increases. Like, it's just not, it's not good to overuse it because there are risks with Pitocin. Third thing I see happening a lot is someone comes in, they're deemed to be in labor. Now, I'm going to tell you right now that active labor is not until 6 centimeters. That's just the truth. Before that, you're in latent labor. And in latent labor, things can ebb and flow. You can make some cervical change and then things can slow down. You can have intense contractions and it kind of goes back and forth. If you get admitted before that, the providers are just asking to have to intervene because they're going to get impatient. They're going to look at your cervical change as a negative thing, that they need to help you, that things are slowing down, when really your body's just doing what it's supposed to do. Admitting people at the true active labor stage, especially first-time moms, if you've had a baby before, it can be kind of unpredictable. So that rule is not hard and fast, but if you're a first-time mom and you're not 6 centimeters, just know that if you are admitted, they're probably going to have the intervention cascade if you're not careful. And so a lot of times they'll get Pitocin, or you come to the hospital and your contractions are 7-8 minutes apart, but you're making cervical change and they say, oh, she needs Pitocin because her contractions are too far apart. That's not true. If you're making cervical change, then the contractions that you're having are working for your body. They will likely get closer as pushing gets closer, but you don't need Pitocin just because your contractions aren't close together, as long as you're making cervical change. The extra items in your room, diapers, blankets, etc., are for you to take home. I think I answered something similar to this the day that I posted this, but typically things that they open up in your room, like diapers, bottles, things like that, are okay to take home because they can't reuse them, like wipes. But linen typically is not okay because they just send that to the launderer and wash it and reuse it. So I would ask them what's okay. Is it true that you can still move around when being continuously monitored during an induction? Heck yes. I have a reel on this that shows you things that you can do while being continuously monitored to keep moving. First of all, you're not stuck in the bed just because you're continuously monitored. Ask if they have wireless monitors. If they don't have wireless monitors, the cords for those monitors are pretty long. So you can still get out of bed and be on the birthing ball and do lunges and different positions to help baby get into the optimal position. Is it going to be harder for your nurse to trace the baby? Yes, but is that your responsibility or their responsibility? It's their responsibility. Is it true that you need a C-section after 48 hours of water being broken? No, there is no hours in which you need a C-section after water is broken. It is true that the more things that enter into your body via your vagina and the longer that your water is broken, you're at increased risk for infection, which puts you at an increased risk for C-section, but it's not an hours mark. It's individual to the patient. If you spend the first 24 hours of labor with no interventions, people not checking your cervix every couple hours, no internal monitors, your risk for infection is going to be lower because you're not introducing more things in there. But if you spend the first 24 hours getting cervical checks every 2 hours, getting internal monitors, things like that, then you're going to have a higher risk for infection. Even if you get chorio, which is the infection of the amniotic fluid, it doesn't mean you need to have a C-section. There are treatments for it. Now, are you on a shorter clock once you get chorio? Yes, because the baby can only tolerate it for so long. We give you antibiotics and Tylenol to treat the fever. And if the baby and your infection responds well to that, then you can keep going. But if the baby stays showing signs of distress, then that's when the decision of C-section will probably be presented to you. But there's not in hours. There's just not. Is it true that I'm required to get internally checked how dilated I am in the weeks before my due date? No. First of all, you're not required to do anything. So if you've been around, I want everyone to change that language. The providers and the healthcare team, they don't let you do anything. You're not required. These are choices that you are making. Everything that they tell you is a recommendation. It's not a hard and fast rule. So I did a TikTok on this not too long ago, but cervical exams in your prenatal appointments are unnecessary unless you're worried you're in labor. Another reason that they may want to do it is if you're trying to decide if you want to be electively induced and they want to check your cervix to see where you're at. Maybe that helps you make your decision. Or if you are going to be induced for some reason and they want to check your cervix to see where you're starting so you guys can start talking about plan of care options. But even then, when you get to the hospital, your cervix may be something different. But some hospitals, how they schedule your inductions on the time of day you come in depends on what medication they're going to give you. So, but just checking you to see what you're doing in there, totally unnecessary. It causes pain and it breeds impatience. It breeds impatience. You are either going to A, be disappointed because your cervix is closed, or B, be super excited because you're 3 or 4 centimeters and then the possibility of still not going into labor for weeks, and that is just crushing. So there's really no reason. Is it true that not every hospital will let you choose the position you want to give birth in? It is true that they will try to make you birth on your back, but the main thing is, are you going to let them dictate the position you give birth in? Because they're not, again, letting you do anything. You're in charge. And you're not in charge of them, but you're in charge of your body. So you can choose to birth how you want to. Now, you may get pushback. I've heard people say, then I'm not going to be your doctor. I'm not going to deliver your baby. That's illegal. They have to take care of you. And if somebody says that to you, you need to bring it up the chain of command. The first person you would tell is the charge nurse. The second person you would tell is the nursing supervisor, which you can get a hold of by either talking to the charge nurse and asking to talk to the nursing supervisor, or you can get a hold of them by just calling the hospital, talking to the operator, and asking to be connected to the nursing supervisor if you're getting pushback. But these are conversations that you should have with your doctor before you go into labor so that you know how supportive that they're going to be, and making it clear to them that you're not going to push on your back. And then when you get admitted to the hospital, because then you'll kind of know like what pushback you are going to receive. Using a pacifier makes nursing harder. So the whole idea of nipple confusion was really debunked. Babies don't really get nipple confusion with pacifiers because they're not getting milk from it. So it's not like they're going to start preferring the pacifier nipple because it's not giving them substance. But what is true is that early use of the pacifier can be a sign of poor feeding. So it is recommended that you wait a couple weeks until breastfeeding is well established to introduce the pacifier so that you're not leaning on the pacifier when really you should be feeding the baby or getting consulted by the lactation consultant. But, you know, it's not a bad thing. If you feel like you need it, it's totally your choice. But I would say that if you are breastfeeding and you feel like your baby needs a pacifier, just check in with a lactation consultant to check your latch and see if there's something going on there. Make sure you have a solid latch before you introduce it. Breech baby must be delivered via C-section. This is not true totally, but there are not very many skilled vaginal breech delivery doctors. So if your baby is breech and you really don't want a C-section, you've done all the things I would definitely start looking into if there's anyone in your area that is skilled in delivering breech. Especially in the United States, they're going few and far between. All right, so we're going to go over to TikTok and see some questions on there. Can you talk about requesting C-section if you have HSV2? Antiviral meds make me super sick. I think that if you want a C-section because you have HSV, which for those of you who don't know is herpes, it's not safe to deliver vaginally if you have an outbreak of herpes, then you can do that. So when you have HSV, and this is what she's talking about 36 weeks, they start recommending you to take the medicine to treat herpes as a preventative measure to prevent it. Because if you have an active outbreak, you cannot deliver vaginally. So they're trying to prevent active outbreak. So for you individually, it depends on how often you get outbreaks. Some people only get one outbreak ever and never again in their life. Some people have frequent outbreaks. Sometimes you don't have outbreaks, but when you're pregnant, it stirs stuff up and you now have outbreaks. So my recommendation would be that don't make a decision right now. Talk to your doctor and say, I really don't want to take Valtrex. I would rather deliver by a C-section than take Valtrex. But that doesn't mean that you'll have an active outbreak at the time of delivery. So you can go all the way to the end, and then when you go in for induction or when you go into labor, they can check for an active outbreak. They can ask you some questions. And if you haven't had one and you don't have one currently, then you can still deliver vaginally. Or if you have one, then it's time for a C-section. So it's not the end-all be-all. After your baby is born, do they have to keep them in the room if you request that? I'm overly paranoid and always want to be able to see my baby. So yes, your baby doesn't have to leave your room as long as they're not needing a higher level of care, like oxygen or IV medication, something like that. The only one thing that I tell patients that, depending on your hospital, may have to be done, or the two things that could possibly have to be done outside of the room. One, a circumcision. That's almost a safe bet. It's going to have to be done outside of the room because that's a sterile procedure. Two, the hearing test. It depends on the hospital and what equipment they have for the hearing test, but some hearing tests are super tiny, can easily be done in the room, and some hearing tests are like big giant machines and can't be moved. That would be the couple things that may have to be done out of the room. The hearing test, depending on where they have the machine set up, you could probably go with or have your support person go with. The circumcision, probably not going to get to go with because A, it's an elective procedure. So they're just going to tell you that if you don't want them to do it without you, then they just won't do it. And B, like I said, it's a sterile procedure. And so they try to keep less people in there. So yeah, guys, that's all the questions that I have. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. It's easy and breezy, and I might do these every couple weeks because you guys have tons of questions for me all the time. Next week, we'll go back to a topic. I have not decided what I want to talk about yet, so if you have any suggestions, feel free to DM me and give me what you want to hear next week on the podcast. As always, please subscribe and follow the podcast. That's the best way to support me. Follow me on TikTok and Instagram @YourBirthAdvocate, and I hope you guys have a great week.